Well, members of the BizNews tribe will remember how James Lorimer, he was then the shadow minister of energy, a member of the Democratic Alliance. As they're part of the government, he's no longer a shadow minister. Now he is a spokesperson on mining. He got terribly excited about the potential for gas in South Africa. We've spoken to various people in the industry, but we don't seem to have ever gotten anywhere until now. Last week, there were a couple of huge developments, including the formation or formalization of an organization called Gas Hub, which is it's a private sector body whose executive officer, Jaco Human, will tell us more about in a moment. Thanks very much for joining us, Jaco. We have been following the story on BizNews. Not too many people have, given that gas has got a massive potential in our country, both the offshore and the onshore gas, to make a big change. And we've got what is called the gas cliff. But let's start at the beginning. From your side, what exactly is Gas Hub?
Morning, Alec. So Gas Hub is born out of basically the market development that are currently taking place in South Africa with regards to natural gas. Traditionally, there's been a single supplier, Sasol, supplying the market, of course, from Mozambique quite successfully over the last 20 years. But that resource is now depleting. In fact, it's already in decline. So Sasol indicated that they will stop supplying natural gas on June 2028. There will be a couple of months in which they will substitute supplies through synthetic gas, but then it stops in June 30. So we got to find alternatives. So the market, of course, South Africa, of course, suffers scale. You know, we are an important market in Africa, but in global terms, it's still relatively small. So now you're sitting with quite a fragmented marketplace. And what industry has decided is to basically pool its buying power in gas. Number one, to advance gas security, gas energy security, but also to have a transactional vehicle in terms of which these large contracts could be concluded, in other words, on a pooled basis. And then I think more importantly, it is about the development of required infrastructure. You know, so this vehicle, this aggregator vehicle, as we call it, is really designed as a marketplace to, number one, secure gas molecules, develop the infrastructure, but then continue supplying on a basis to industry going forward.
Okay, so I can imagine immediately there's some people saying that's going to be a cartel. They are going to manipulate prices, and people outside are going to get hurt. I know I've read your statements. I know that's not the case, but maybe you should tell us why.
No, of course. So you know, the departure point of this particular project, and we started this project in all earnest about 2 years ago. We actually started with a big feasibility study, but the departure point here was actually the Competition Commission. And the Competition Commission, because of the energy crises we have in South Africa, it's not only gas. I mean, it's power. It is all types, liquid fuels, etc. It's also probably in the making. But the Competition Commission provided exemption for buyers and sellers of energy to actually do exactly this in order to facilitate the development of alternative solutions. And this is largely in a world where I think the Competition Commission, the markets also realize that the state is not capable on its own to develop these large infrastructure projects anymore. So I think, you know, in the absence, this is typically a role which the state should fulfill, you know, this sort of network type infrastructure and developments, but it's not. So this is the sort of outcome of this. So it is closely monitored by the Competition Commission. But I think the very nature of this particular platform, there's a big distinction here between aggregation, what we see as true aggregation. Now, this is a world where there's aggregation not for profit. In other words, the buyer buys and sells to himself. All right. So there's it's designed not to make profit. It's got to cover its costs, of course. So number one. And number two, it's fully transparent for those that are participating in this. It's an open access platform. That is very important. It's an open access platform and designed the architecture of that is such that anyone can join. So there's a few checks and balances in this very complex organization, or the architecture is quite complex, as you can imagine. But there are very key underlying checks and balances that would essentially govern itself, you know, in this regard.
So let me understand this better. People in the private sector are facing the end of supply of gas from Sasol in 2028, then going on to 2030. So 2030, it's over. So you're making a plan. But on the other hand, last week we had the PIC saying, we will support projects in South Africa that are going to be exploiting our incredible gas reserves, which no one's really done much with up to this point. Now, with you guys, with the private sector coming together with this gas hub, you've got the demand side. So it's almost like if I wanted to do a project, a gas project, I could go to the PRC and say, fund this because these guys are going to give me, and I suppose here's a big question, a guaranteed offtake, because you've got this grouping of pretty much everybody who consumes gas in South Africa. And I suppose that's just to understand it in layman's terms.
So these announcements by the PIC is quite critical. It comes at a critical point in the development of our gas markets. Now, as I said, although industry is grouped together to form a aggregator in order to make certain things happen, infrastructure and so on, it still suffers scale. A block on its own, even if it is a block, that block is not sufficient to underwrite the infrastructure guarantees and, you know, that underpins these investments. Now, what we're seeking right now is, in fact, for the state to pick up and soften some of this investments, all right? It's pretty much very similar to type of a toll road concession that you get, or even if you wish, the Gautrain development, you know, in South Africa, of course, where the government steps in and say, listen, there's various ways to structure these things, but a typical one would be a first loss cover, for example, that gives the developers of the infrastructure the comfort that should something go wrong in the market, that they will come in, the state will come in to cover this. Now, right now, it is only the private sector that is faced with providing these guarantees, and they are significant. They are absolutely significant. They're long-term in nature, Alec. I mean, you're talking here 10, 15 years to underwrite gas supply, infrastructure investments, and these are running into billions of rands, all right? So it is important that, and we are actually advocating and calling for the state so that we can get around the table and see how do we fiscally package this transaction? Because that, to me, is the most important key to unlock the gas cliff, to mitigate the gas cliff, rather, and unlock the gas potential for South Africa in future. I think what the private sector is saying is that use us, all right? We can certainly contribute, but we need that safety net, you know, from the state. And it will be very interesting. I think it's early days, but it will be very interesting to see where the PIC is going to play, whether it's going to be on the demand side, which essentially is power stations and the like, or whether it's going to be in this midstream infrastructure, pipelines, terminals, and so on, or indeed upstream. You know, so I think it is an important announcement by the PIC, and in fact, we would be seeking to engage them very shortly to understand exactly how does this all fit in.
Robertson, a small town in the middle of nowhere where a wine farmer claims to have sold a Volkswagen up to e-bike cars.
A farmer?
What car did you really sell them?
A VW.
Right here in Robertson?
Small town, but we know about e-bike cars.
Yeah, but what's a farmer doing with a VW up?
It was just a runaround.
Cool cover story. And I see you traded it in for this, like a double cab Renault. Were they all out of Rangers?
We buy cars, the easiest way to sell your car by far.
Well, the PIC did give us some hints in its official statement. On the one hand, it was talking about a 3,000 megawatt operational gas to power operation in Richards Bay. And then about the Eskom transforming to its two diesel-driven plants at the moment in Asher, is it Asherley and
Avon, anyway? Avon and Ankerlich, maybe. Avon de Diesel. Okay.
Yeah, those two, which are now being driven by diesel at the moment, moving them into gas. So you need gas to be able to do that in the first place. And I guess we've had so much feedback about this resource that exists in South Africa and offshore in South Africa. What is your reading of it? And maybe we should start from the west of the country. We got crazy exploration and development going on in Namibia. And just to the south of Namibia, where our border starts at zero, Zippo. What's going on there? How come we have the same geology, we have everything the
incredible
same?
Incredible story.
The Namibians are going nuts, and we got nothing.
It's an incredible story, you know. So just let us step one step back. So I think where we would have liked to be 10 or 15 years further down the track with regards to our own domestic resources, of which we are clearly endowed, as you rightly point out, but we've missed the boat. Whether from a policy, planning, private sector invitation, you know, to explore, etc., these kind of things. And we will be compelled to bridge the gas cliff with LNG from the East Coast, all right, to plug the timeline. So park that for the moment. The reality is that in South Africa, we actually don't sit with a demand side problem. You know, I mean, you rightly said, I mean, you know, if you open the policy documents today, there's 18 gigawatts of gas to power lined up towards the end of next decade, 6 before the end of this decade, which is significant on the demand side. Industry needs gas. Sasol needs gas. So these are big, big demand pockets. We cannot sustain the economy on LNG. It is expensive. The importance then comes in on the West Coast. And the West Coast gas, in our opinion, is the medium-term roadmap for South Africa. Without a doubt, we need to develop and monetize those resources with speed. Why do we think of Namibia first? Of course, because they are much further down the track. In fact, they are talking about first gas probably around about 2033, all right, which is literally around the corner. We are looking at ways to, or the feasibility actually, we are considering the feasibility of landing that gas, for example, in Sasolburg. In other words, a West Coast Sasolburg type pipeline that also spurs down to Cape Town. Cape Town, Saldanha, Ankerlich, all these places got huge demand for gas. So the West Coast gas is a critical economic play for industry. In fact, We see it very similar to the reindustrialization of the smelting sector. Even the mining sector can leverage. Certainly industry, the power sector, you know, will have a whole set of different economics, because currently the policy documents is based on $15 gas. We think it is feasible to land gas in Sasolburg between $6 and $8. That is a significant shift. It is a significant shift. So West Coast gas is absolutely critical. Two plays. The midstream, in other words, how do you connect demand with supply, that pipelines, in other words, and then the upstream play. We will see first gas flow under this sort of, let's call it hypothesis, we will see first gas flow from Namibia, not South Africa, right? But you got to bring in South Africa potential at some point. Now, to answer your question, why is Namibia so far advanced rather than us? I think, number one, it's because of the regulatory environment, the difference in regulatory environments. We're currently sitting with a very unique set of, how can I say, judicial mechanics or mechanisms, which essentially means that anyone can stop these significant catalytic projects for the South African economy by virtue of the Act, the Constitution, et cetera, et cetera. And these processes get sort of stopped from an environmental perspective on a regular basis, and the projects are set back 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, you know, whatever it takes. Now, there's nothing wrong in these challenges. We're not saying that anyone should not challenge it. But what is missing in the judicial system in South Africa is actually a type of technical and economic and environmental tribunal that can balance up, that can balance out these considerations in an informative and knowledgeable manner and rational manner to say this project is allowed rather than this one. All right. So what is happening at the moment is these mega projects with mega potential offshore are actually stopped by, you know, I would almost say elementary elements around consultation. All right. You know, you didn't publish a consultation process in a particular newspaper in a particular language. All right. So now the whole project stops. All right. And we are actually shooting ourselves in the foot economically. All right. Economies are built on energy. South African economy, as we know today, has been built on energy, coal energy in the 50s, 40s and 50s. We can do the same with gas, and therein lies a massive potential. But we have to sort out the judicial we advocating for a judicial tribunal on these energy type projects that are prevailing, because at the moment we don't see that the right decisions are coming from the courts in terms of balancing economic imperatives with developmental imperatives and social imperatives.
That's so interesting. And we have a neighbor, in fact, two neighbors, both Namibia and Mozambique, who the important part is if they've got plenty of oil and gas, we have it as well because we have a similar geology. And yet they are running ahead and being terribly exciting prospects for international oil and gas majors. And we in South Africa are sterile. Because of that's a very interesting point you make there. So we can learn from them, implement their legislation in South Africa, and create jobs, because that's what it's about, isn't it?
I had a very interesting conversation with a senior government official in Namibia recently, where I asked him the exact same question. Why is it that Namibia can advance, but South Africa is still lagging? And this conversation around the regulatory sort of let's call it machinery came up. What was very interesting is that he indicated to me at that point, and this was a couple of weeks ago, he just came back from a countrywide consultation, all right, with communities, public voter districts, etc., discussing the gas potential, gas and oil potential in Namibia. What is interesting to note, he said to me, there is not one community that is actually opposing the development of oil and gas. There are concerns around global climate impacts and these kind of things, particularly from the youth, right? But not one single community is actually advocating against this. Yet, 50 kilometers down, you know, on the South African side of the border, it is the communities are seemingly up in arms around these developments. And our view is, and this is speculative, but our view is that these initiatives are actually foreign sponsored. All right. And it's commonly accepted or generally accepted that, you know, there are, of course, these, let's call it global North green agendas. And these agendas seek to stop carbon based projects, which gas, of course, is. But then also to find an easy home. All right. And South Africa is an easy home because of our judicial structure, you know, that we have. So it is a very, very interesting dynamic and a very interesting topic for conversation.
I guess there are lots of people who wish South Africa harm, who do not want South Africa to develop. And as a consequence, they can use the useful idiots to forward those agendas. But if you start at the very beginning, this country needs to develop. It's got massive unemployment. It's got this huge resource. It's a little bit, I suppose, like thinking of where we were before the gold boom of the Witwatersrand. Imagine if back then Wimpole had said, well, no, we're not going to pull any gold out of this because we want to stay as a backward farming country indefinitely. Well, it would be a very different country today, and surely there's an opportunity to look at those parallels.
Exactly. So, and you know, one can say exactly the same in terms of how this country was built on coal energy. All right. But what excites us more actually is this energy transition that we see in the industrial space, and we in short, what industry sees is more gas, more renewables, less coal. All right. And, but it's a journey. All right. It's a journey that takes time. And I think we are faced with some serious decisions right now. We can actually completely deindustrialize the economy, or we can actually then leverage this gas and the renewable energy potential. And for me, the latter, of course, makes sense, particularly in the African context.
Interesting point that you make as well about the smelters, which are closing at an alarming rate because the electricity price is too high. Would gas make them viable again?
I believe so. You know, I mean, so now if it comes back to the West Coast gas set of economics, right? Assume for a moment that you can have, let's say, $7 gas in Sasolburg, right? Or perhaps even, or Cape Town for that matter, or you can have $6 gas in the Northern Cape, right? So that set of economics allows you to generate your own electricity, for example, and use that energy for smelting purposes, etc. But you then bring down your energy cost probably to 1 rand 20, 1 rand 25 per kilowatt hour, instead where the mega flex, you know, for large industrial users, probably is trailing around about two rand per kilowatt hour at the moment on average. It is a different set of economics which could potentially reset the investment plans of these organizations, for sure.
We've heard a lot about the Karoo and fracking in the Karoo, and there was one report from the international agency that said South Africa had the fourth largest shale gas reserves in the world. I'm not sure if that's accurate, but certainly it's in the top 10. And we've seen how shale gas has transformed the US energy picture. They're a net exporter rather than an importer, as they were. What is the status of that, and is it reality? Do we really have such an exciting prospect in the Karoo? And if so, why does no one really want to exploit it?
So stepping back about 10, 15 years, let's say around about 2010, around that time, of course, the prospect of shale gas in the Karoo, and it was a very, topical coming out of the US, you know, during that time. Shale gas was a very topical topic in terms of, you know, where do we explore and where do we take it. So the reserves in the Karoo Basin is far from proven, all right, number one. So and there is a likelihood of it, and I would certainly support that notion that there may be some gas for fracturing available in the Karoo. But what does it take? It takes significant infrastructure developments. And we're not only talking here about a few pipelines. You're talking about roads. You're talking about water. You're talking about significant power, all right, that needs to be laid out in an area which essentially is a semi-desert. Now, I think at a practical level, we are probably a decade or two away from actually getting to that point. I think from an infrastructure priority perspective and investment perspective, it would be very difficult because of all these infrastructure developments, you're talking rail, roads, electricity, water, needs to be brought to these places. So I think practically I put a different sort of gear on those developments. Environmentally, of course, there are environmental implications, all right, for this, but that, And there's particularly in the Karoo, what we see is that there are significant plays, all right, in terms of trying to avoid this exploitation in the Karoo. Personally, I think the Karoo is probably one of the most beautiful places in the world, all right. And I think these dynamics will play out, and it will take, and there are key players behind these dynamics. And I think it will take time to play out. I see much more potential on the West Coast, you know, rather than the Karoo.
All right, so park the Karoo for the moment, because it's too complicated. As Warren Buffett would say, you can buy this, you can sell this, and then by far his biggest folder is too complicated. That's too complicated. But on the West Coast, we've got Namibia going great guns there. On the east coast of South Africa, you've got the Mozambican field, and particularly up to the north of Mozambique, which is the second biggest gas field in the world behind the Qatari-Iranian gas field. What about that? When, now that it appears as though the Islamists have been at least kept out of the area, and that we do have ExxonMobil and Total going back in there and getting those mass billions, tens of billions of dollars projects going again. What is the likelihood of South Africa being able to extract that gas? Or is it all going to be this LNG, as you mentioned earlier, which is expensive because it needs to be frozen and so on?
So Mozambique, you are right. I mean, the north of Mozambique, and one should always keep in mind distance, right? I mean, the north of Mozambique, which is essentially on the Tanzania border, you know, Mozambique's got a coastline of probably 3,000 kilometers. It is vast, absolutely vast, right? So those developments are significant. There is probably by 2029, extent of about $100 billion would flow into those, the development of those and exploitation of those gas resources and the monetization thereof. We see some domestic gas coming from that in terms of pipeline gas, but it's going to be localized probably towards Tanzania rather than this part of the world by virtue of distance. So, I think in a nutshell, it is LNG focused, and what these international players do like Exxon, Total, Eni, etc., Shell, they actually just put these products into their global portfolios. It becomes a commodity. And there's very little advantage of actually having those LNG, you know, relatively close, other than perhaps a few cents on logistics and shipping, all right, which one could, of course, capitalize on. But I think it is an LNG play, and LNG is available, like, you know, we call it the new crude, all right? So it is globally available. There's no shortage. In fact, there's probably, we're heading into an oversupply of LNG on a cyclical basis. But it is interesting, and it is beneficial for Mozambique at this point. South Africa is unlikely to get some of that benefit across, purely because of its distance from market.
Thank you for explaining that. In other words, it would be like when we buy crude oil in South Africa, we pay the same as people who are much, much closer to the Middle East oil fields, it because it's packaged and put onto a container ship and sent down here. So the real opportunity for South Africa would be to exploit its own gas resources, obviously, which have not been exploited. And you've explained that that's because we don't have the right legislation in place. And secondly, Namibia, which is a lot closer to this country than Mozambique is. And that does seem to be a very exciting. I've seen it being described by Wood Mackenzie as the most exciting oil and gas district in the world at the moment.
It is. And we see significant benefits for the Namibian economy as a result of this. Excellent multipliers around this. If you attend meetings in Namibia and conferences and the like around this gas, oil and gas developments, you know, it is a whole sector of the economy. It's not only about extraction offshore, but it's the overall support networks that sits on shore. All right, you're talking technical, engineering, food, you know, medical, et cetera, education, schooling. I mean, it's a whole economic system, ecosystem that is developed around these finds. And I'm personally very excited for Namibia and the Namibian people. They will leverage this, and I think the Namibian government is approaching this in a very cautious and smart manner in order to get the most benefit. I mean, immediately they are already in sort of a Norwegian type world of sovereign wealth funds, and, you know, to bring those benefits into the state coffers and ultimately the community. So I think Namibia is really, and they're open for learning. All right. The Namibian government, the officials, the people of Namibia are absolutely open for learning to say, show us how these things are done properly. And I'm very excited for Namibia. The Namibia play is indeed very exciting.
But then bring it back to South Africa. If by some miracle, you had a magic wand and you waved it and you said, right, let's replicate what the Namibians have been doing tomorrow. How long would it take for us to start exploiting our own resources that are sitting sterile at the moment?
I would say a minimum 10 years, Alec. You know, so these things do take time. Although, you know, if you take an organization, you know, particularly on the West Coast, we've seen in the recent media, Total Energies trying to drill testing holes. All right. So this is where you start. You first start off with a geological assessment without sort of any physical impact. You then move to test drilling and you start building a profile from probable resources to proven resources. And that takes time. All right. So, and we see it now in Namibia is that they actually now in a phase of proving resources and they're very close. Right. But it does take time. Namibia has been at it now for probably the last 5-6 years. Right. So we're not there immediately. Unfortunately, we actually haven't seen any domestic gas exploitation, on scale. All right. Offshore for, I think, the last 10, 15 years. Most recently was the Leopard Brulpadda, in the South Coast. It is there. I believe it can render gas, for use, but it needs an offtaker. And that offtaker is either power or the government. You know, there's no real industrial use, for that gas, or, you know, the market is just not there for industrial. So, we need to move along. But we haven't over the last 10, 15 years, and we're now getting to a point where it's pivotal that these things move around. I have to say that I think from a South African government perspective, they're starting to wake up to this potential. All right. Minister Mantashe is very vocal about the potential to develop gas, what it means. We still don't know what we're going to do in the midstream space, right? That is important as a government and private sector that we find a solution, a fiscal solution for that.
What is midstream?
Pipelines, you know. So this is typically what we refer to as the infrastructure that is required to link a market, the demand side with the supply side. All right. So we've got upstream, which is offshore or onshore even, but it's the extraction of oil and gas. Midstream deals with the delivery portion, if you wish. In power terms, you would equate it to a transmission line, right? And then on the downstream side is demand, all right, or consumption. Now, we don't have a demand issue. We actually see demand increasing fivefold for gas in South Africa over the next 10, 15 years. And we got to find the solutions to bring that on stream economically. Otherwise, we're going to be dependent on LNG. And as we say in industry, LNG, because of the economics of LNG, we see it as an industrial slow puncture.
You did mention the Southern Cape resources, Brulpadda and Leopard fields, that Total has discovered. They're there. We know that they're very exciting. But Total moved out because, well, why? Why did they not? If you think they're in Namibia, they're in Mozambique, this would be a nice trifecta.
Exactly. So Total Brulpadda, I mean, has really only got one point of offset, and that is Mossel Bay, right? And it links into the existing infrastructure that was there that supported the Mosgas refinery, Petro SA's refinery there for some time. So Mossel Bay is the demand node for that gas. I think it was a failure between the state and Total to reach transactional close on pricing, right? But pricing for refinery is not necessarily pricing for power generation. It's a different set of economics, all right? For me, it is very unfortunate that we have not managed to actually leverage that resource. What we need in Mossel Bay today, essentially, I'm not hopeful in terms of the refinery starting up, right? But I am hopeful that gas to power could play a significant role to underpin the development of that. But it needs the parties, of course, the government and the developers that are there to reach commercial close on these. And then lies the difficulty, because I think on the state side, there are just all these different agendas and what needs to happen by when, to whom. And, you know, we've lived through the sagas of Mosgas now. You know, there was a year or two ago, the issues around the tenders that were awarded to, you know, people to revive the refineries, and the Russians became involved. And so it is very, very complex, unfortunately. But it needs power. And with that power, of course, you need to upgrade the transmission or the evacuation of that power into the national grid. So it's a bit of a longer-term project. We're projecting by the middle of the next decade that Leeuwpoort-Brulpadda will come on stream.
Well, it's quite interesting when you talk about scale, but the Cape independence advocates would say here is a perfect example of a wonderful resource that if they'd been more focused and it wasn't decided upon thousands of kilometers away, it would have long ago have been gone forward. But it is what it is. Just tell us a little more about GasHub and who you say in your information that it's 22 founding members from all across industry. Who are these members, and how much demand do they need, or do they need fulfilled?
So. The third party market in South Africa for gas is roughly about 65 petajoules. You can almost break it down, say 25 in KZN and about 40 petajoules in the Gauteng and Mpumalanga regions.
Now what's a petajoule? Sorry, Jaco. Yeah, what is a petajoule?
So a petajoule is essentially a million gigajoules, right? And a gigajoule of energy is essentially the equivalent of that, what we may be more accustomed to, is the 19 kilogram LPG cylinder that you get, the one that's sort of waist height, you know, that you stand next to. That is more or less 1 gigajoule of energy. Now, industry uses 65 million of those, right? So it is sizable, but not all of these players can actually, in their businesses, actually afford LNG, because it's a significant step change from gas supplied by Sasol at the moment to LNG, probably 100% plus, right, that we're looking at. So it
price
is a significant
increase, you're saying. You mean it costs 100% more, double.
100%. So it costs more, and not all of these sectors are actually going to continue on LNG in the future. I'm talking post the gas cliff. So now you're sitting with a reduced market. Key players in this, it's cross-sectoral. You're sitting in the FMCG space. You're sitting with breweries. You're sitting with packaging manufacturers, glass, metal, etc. You're sitting with food production, right? Mainly, you know, companies like Premier, AVI, that sits in that space. The bread we eat is actually baked on gas. You know, much of the bread we eat is baked with gas. So it is important in the mix. You're sitting with the ceramics, the steel sector, aluminium, South32s, the scores of the world, etc., and the glass manufacturers, right, which are all heavy intensive energy users. So it cuts really across, and then there's the chemical sector as well. There's some chemical operations that needs gas, you know, for chemical purposes. You're talking polymers here, etc. So it really cuts across a broad sector of the manufacturing sector, and they now have said, listen, well, I don't see an alternative yet. The current supplier, the government is not moving, etc. What do we do? All right. So there's safety in numbers, so to speak. And these companies have now banded together. So the mechanisms behind GasHub is essentially that your shareholding is relative to your proportionate gas use. In other words, if I'm a steel manufacturer and I'm a big gas user, right, I will carry more of a share than, let's say, the smaller workshop that or the medium-sized enterprise that sits on the in an industrial complex. So it is proportionate in nature. They carry risk on a proportionate basis. Those participants that are shareholders are essentially, they've got full visibility and transparency in terms of all the agreements that sit across the value chain, buying. It's not, you know, it's molecules, it's pipeline agreements, it is terminal user agreements. And of course, they enter into sales agreements, purchase and sales agreements with Gas Hub. All right. So it's a complete flow through. The whole system is based on a cost pass through where, and this is an important distinction, Alec, is many companies are actually saying, I'll be your aggregator for gas. All right. But in essence, it means I just want to have a super position in the market and I want to make a profit, a big profit out of my super position. Where this model is slightly different, well, not slightly, fundamentally different in the sense that it is simply there to facilitate the movement and the transactional side on a cost pass-through basis. What we anticipate with this aggregator as it matures is that it's a flexible model, so you can have more coming in, shareholders coming in, and there's a continuous reset of shareholding and obligations. What we anticipate is that this entity would in future mature to also move into the infrastructure space. All right. Own pipelines or, you know, shares in pipelines, et cetera, in order to facilitate the access to gas and the associated transactions. So it is a relatively complex model. But it is not the first time that it's been done. You know, if you think about, you know, typical agricultural co-op type world, all right, this is more or less, very similar. Like I say, we have the regulatory support for this from the Competition Commission and NERSA, in fact, which is very encouraging. And we will be now sort of, drive the commercial side first to secure and enter into these type supply agreements across the value chain. That is our first priority at this point in time.
I get a feeling the guys at Sarkolige would love this because they say you need to state-proof yourself. Having a state-run body privatized, it sounds a bit like that if in an ideal world you'd have the state putting this together rather than the private sector. Is this part of stepping up to fulfill gaps?
I think you're spot on with that. And we see this happening across the, let's call it conventional network economics, right? Now, network economics, as you can see, you know, if you talk post office, if you talk telecoms, water, power, gas, logistics, ports, all these kind of things, what we see in the economic development of South Africa is actually the state's role in this is declining, right? It's painful because industries now are, as we see it every day, you know, large manufacturing concerns or mines taking responsibility for these utility type worlds, right? And they vertically integrate into that and they take actions in order to continue supply and so on. That outcome is exactly what we faced with here. Ideally, we would have liked the government to step in to say, I have a solution for you. Don't worry, you can carry on and focus with your manufacturing, all right? But it's not happening, all right? So we are protecting the economy in our opinion through initiatives of this nature, but it's not only gas, all right? We see it elsewhere as well. So you're quite right. I mean, it is a natural development. You know, if you take how many private power producers there are today, all right? 10, 15 years ago, there were only one power producer in South Africa. And I think it's part of our economic discourse over the next couple of decades.
And your own background, how did you get drawn into this very important role?
So I'm an economist, and I've always been exposed to energy. You know, I started my working career in the 90s with Eskom. I moved into various corporate positions, you know, and I've always been exposed to natural gas in those roles, which were largely commercial in nature. Roughly towards the 2018, 2019, prior to that, we were a bunch of corporates that were looking at the interests of gas pricing predominantly because it was a regulatory, issue. And around about 2018-19, we had a discussion and we said, listen, we are faced with some serious headwinds, all right? It's not going to be easy journey. It's going to be tough. It's going to be difficult. We will have to do some groundbreaking stuff, but we've got to create then a body or a vehicle. It started off with the IGUA SA, the Industrial Gas User Association of Southern Africa, which is still continuing. It's a lobby group that focuses on gas energy security and policy mainly. And out of that, we then created Gas Hub as a commercial vehicle then to secure our gas energy. So that's more or less the development of it. And I think the next couple of years is going to be extremely exciting in the gas energy space. And our role is mainly to ensure that industry can access cost-efficient gas energy, whether mitigating the gas cliff or leveraging the potential of the West Coast, which is our absolute focus now going forward.
So it might be a situation, you've got 4.5 years of Sasol left, if you like, supplying the market, that you would have to bring in LNG in the same way as you bring in crude oil with the old refineries for a period of time, but clearly to try and find an alternative and a low cost alternative to that, if you can get everyone around the table. Just one final question. Don Ngobe, who's an old friend of mine who started Real Africa Investments 20, 30 years ago and did very well for his shareholders there, he's got pretty involved in Mpumalanga, and they're involved with a company called Kinetico, which he sold his business into. Kinetico, from what Don tells me, it's very exciting. They've found some fabulous reserves and resources there. Is that big enough to make a dent in the gas demand to supply into Gas Hub?
In developing supply strategies for the South African market, of course, we are in discussions with the Kineticos of the world. The Renergence is a very similar type development, of course, in Virginia and or in the Free State province. So these developments are quite niche, right? The economics are very different. Right. The economics are mainly targeted for the displacement of very expensive diesel fuels, LPG, which really sits at the upper end of the energy cost spectrum. And it's relatively low volumes or small volumes. Without a doubt, there's significant gas in that part of the world, you know, in Mpumalanga, Amersfoort area, etc. But one also needs to understand the characteristics of these resources. Right. So typically you need vast areas to essentially trickle gas out of the ground rather than a very concentrated high pressure resource, right, which can supply in bulk. All right. So that's sort of the unique geological characteristics of these finds. But without a doubt, it will make a dent in the energy landscape in South Africa, but more so, I think, in a very niche sector. You know, what we refer to as distributed LNG, et cetera. I think in future, there may well be the potential to tap into the existing pipeline networks, you know, for those developments. But it is, you know, to answer your question, I think it is relatively small, and it's not designed to supply to be a solution for the gas cliff, number one. But they will see the light of day, and in fact, we're very excited about that.
And before you go, we've mentioned LNG a lot in this conversation, almost assuming that people understand what it is. Would you give us a in a nutshell, what LNG stands for and what it means?
So, not to be confused with LPG, now liquid petroleum gas, that is typically what we buy at our garage forecourt to fire our braais on a Sunday, right, or cook on. So, LPG is part of the refining process of crude or, you know, and so on. LNG is liquefied natural gas. So it's natural gas coming out of the ground, much of what we've discussed today. But what then happens is through a process of thermodynamics, they actually cool it down to minus 162 degrees. Now, then what happens is it's like steam to water, all right? Steam cools down and it becomes water. Of course, it's a different set of thermodynamics because it's minus 162 degrees. It then collapses into a liquid, a very dense energy type. And that dense energy type is a ratio of about 1 to 800 in terms of natural gas versus liquid, the energy content, and it enables the movement of this gas around the world very cost efficiently. Right. So liquefied natural gas comes out of the ground. It goes through a system of compression or liquefaction, as we call it, becomes a liquid. It gets shipped. It reaches a terminal, let's say in Richards Bay or in Mozambique. It gets transferred into a terminal. It sits there as a liquid at minus 162 degrees, pretty much like in a coffee flask, all right? And then it gets pumped out of the terminal, and it goes through a radiator system, and it heats up, and it almost becomes steam again. And then it becomes a normal gas molecule, and you ship it down the pipeline. So that's more or less the it is a significant development in the global energy landscape. So the shipment of LNG around the world, which is significant.
And because of the process, it's more expensive clearly than just taking a pipeline of the gas. Mm-hmm. I suppose a little bit in my head, it sounds a bit like supercharged water into ice. It's going to be quite hard or much easier to transport ice than it is to transport lots of water if you wanted to do that.
For that, steam for that matter, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm. All right, well, that does help a lot. Thank you very much, Jaco. It's been a real pleasure talking with you. Jaco Human is the executive officer at Gas Hub, the new private sector initiative to aggregate demand for gas in South Africa and to kickstart the gas revolution, one hopes. The PIC last week, the Public Investment Commissioners, said that they are going to be supporting the development of gas projects in South Africa. The PIC's got quite a few trillion rand. So for the first time in a long, long while, we're looking to our neighbors to the west and the east and starting to learn from their example, because there's big things happening in the gas field on both of those, and South Africa has the same resources. We just haven't got around to extracting or developing them yet. But with the initiatives that we're seeing, well, who knows? Maybe that's all changing. I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.